Hello. Welcome back to The Sower, a podcast of the Ciceronian Society. We are an interdisciplinary group of Christian scholars dedicated to the study of tradition, place, and things divine. To learn more about us, our podcasts, our annual conference, and to sign up for our newsletter, please go to ciceroniansociety.org. I'm Chris Annadale, podcast editor for the Society and associate professor of philosophy at Mount St. Mary's University. My guests today are my two good friends, Michael Harding and Bill Batchelder. Michael is professor of philosophy and chair of humanities at Montgomery College in Maryland, and Bill is professor of history and honors program director at Waynesburg University in southwest Pennsylvania. They are co-editors of The Philosophy of Philip Reeve, a book published about a year ago by Bloomsbury Academic. All three of us contributed chapters to the book, which is about the thought of the late American sociologist and cultural critic, Philip Reeve. I'll put a link to the book in the description of this episode. We're here today to introduce our listeners to Reeve, outline the main themes of his life's work, and discuss his significance for our cultural moment. And let me say parenthetically that Bill Batchelder is one of the few people alive today who has read every word that Philip Reeve ever published, which is no mean feat. Gentlemen, welcome to the show.
I think that's right.
Not many people have done that. There's a lot of stuff. That's a lot of books and a lot of articles and lectures, yes?
Well, he did have a remarkable career, even though it was broken in the middle by what one critic referred to as his academic suicide. So maybe it would help to lay out his publications and significance, because he has fallen into a impardonable obscurity, which is one of the things that all three of us have been working on correcting. And I'm pleased to say that I'm involved in a project which should even do more to correct that in the upcoming couple of years. When people use the word interdisciplinary, that doesn't begin to comprehend Reeve's work, which is staggering in the range from Protestant theology, Catholic theology, Jewish Torah commentary, philosophy, political theory, psychology, sociology, and in particular, literature and art. And he was comfortable everywhere. And of course, the academy, diseased as it is at the moment with hyper-specialization, would discourage just the sort of work that Reeve did. But when we kind of think back to the people that do the work, which is the most impactful and the most interesting and the most lasting, it's not people who decide how many coin ridges there are on a coin stamped by Diocletian in 303. That's not actually what lasts and what's impactful. What lasts and what's impactful is very often these people who brazenly and daringly go into fields that quote unquote aren't theirs and work really widely and really broadly. And that's certainly what Reeve did. His master's was on Coleridge and his PhD was on the political implications of Freud. Both of those were done at the University of Chicago, where he was lecturing before he was even finished with his dissertation. First big publication, 1959, Freud, The Mind of the Moralist, which was heavily edited. I think you could even say co-edited or with contributions by his then wife, Susan Sontag. Since then, a biography of hers has attempted to give her credit for the book, which is absurd. There's an article to that effect on Vogel and View where we dismantle that absurd claim. But that really made his early reputation. His reputation was made internationally in 1966 with the publication of The Triumph of the Therapeutic, The Uses of Faith After Freud, which was also done with a second edition with an introduction by Elizabeth Lash Quinn about 20 years ago, and paperback is very affordable. Between then, in 1963, he was the editor for the papers of Freud, and his compilation of Freud's papers was published, and each of the volumes has an introduction by Reeve, as well as being the general editor there. And in 1965, he was made the Benjamin Franklin Professor of Sociology at the University of Pennsylvania, which is an appointment he kept until he retired. The Triumph of the Therapeutic, again, has sort of made his international reputation. And it dealt with not only the what he called the analytic attitude and the sort of very individualistic analytic attitude of Freud and his approach to dealing with neuroses with the individual patient, but it also dealt with the fact that Freud's most gifted disciples all felt the need to go beyond him. And most of them wanted to go beyond him into some kind of, the term he uses is therapies of commitment. That is to say, all of them intuited something that Rief actually agreed with, which is, and I'm quoting Rief here, quote, it's the community that cures. That is to say, the sort of hyper-individualistic approach. You say, well, how could you call Freudian therapy hyper-individualistic? After all, it has both the analyst and the analysand, right? It is two people. But the role of the therapist in Freud is simply to have the person work through to the origin of their neuroses. It's still very much an individualistic endeavor. And there's other aspects of the book too, but that's one of the key ones. And so he looks at Jung, who he's not a fan of, and he looks at Wilhelm Reich, and he looks at Adler, and then he looks at other people that are Freudian influence, but not necessarily therapists, Michael, who's the author of Sons and Lovers?
Oh, I couldn't tell you.
That's D.H. Lawrence.
D.H. Lawrence, right? Because of course, Lawrence was profoundly stamped by Freud, and so he kind of works through the implications of these sort of wayward children of Freud, and contrasts them. It's an incredible opening chapters explaining Freud, which are just. They're so good. And then he goes on and looks at how these people depart. And this really made his international reputation, which he then proceeded to turn his back on in 1973 with the publication of Fellow Teachers. Fellow Teachers is where he debuted his later writing style, which borders on the impenetrable. And it was also, a Ton Zondervan, whose book on Rief is fantastic, and anyone interested in Rief should read. Zondervan said this was deliberate academic suicide. Some of the most important arguments are in the notes. He didn't number the chapters. He made no heading separations. It did appear to be deliberately off-putting. So at this point, a poet who was an admirer of Rief's called this period from 1973 into 2006 his Great Silence. Now, that's not exactly right. First of all, it's not exactly right because he published two really important articles, At Last Psychology and Oscar Wilde and the Impossible Culture. And if you want to understand Rief, you have to look at those. And in my opinion, the most important thing that he published during the Great Silence is the epilogue to the third edition to Freud, The Mind of the Moralist, called One Step Further, where he really gets into the most profound and fundamental difference that he has with Freud. Rief never stopped being a Freudian, but he never stopped dissenting from Freud, which is one of the interesting things about him. I am happy to report that Michael and I are involved with a team of scholars. His Great Silence, the silence part has been overrated. The fact of the matter is, after 1973, he gave incredibly prestigious invited lectures, which have kind of been sitting in the collection of scholars and students of his who loved him and are devoted to him and understand him at a really deep level. They have these, but they've not been circulated. I mean, some of these haven't been looked at by more than five or six people in 20 years. But Rief actually gave the Gauss seminars at Princeton at the Institute for Advanced Study in 1979. He gave the Terry lectures at Yale in 75. He gave the Terry lectures at Yale in 1977. He was invited to do the Trilling lecture at Columbia in 1979, where Trilling's widow was present, and where delightfully one of his respondents was the great Christopher Lash. He followed Cardinal Ratzinger in an invited lecture series at the University of Toronto in 1986. So great silence might have been overstating it. He continued to be greatly esteemed in the academy and invited to these major significant lectures. And there's many others too. Those are the highlights. We're looking at, as Michael knows, as he's part of the project too, hundreds of pages of lectures that are now being edited, and, as is often required with Reif, annotated, and introduced. And these go from reel-to-reel recordings, which have been found and turned to MP3 so that we could use with them. I think the earliest we have is Reif doing about a 35-minute talk on the civil rights movement, which is fascinating. And the latest is one from 19, is it 1996, Michael? The one from medical college.
Is that from that might be 96, yeah.
Yeah, I think it's 1996, which is there, and they're wonderful. And often Reif makes no concession to the reader after 1973. None. And as a matter of fact, David Reif, in an email to me, said his father felt that his readers needed to work for it. Well, they certainly do. But in his talks, he did make concessions to his hearers. And one of the things that Michael and I have found, and the other our friends in this group have found, is that the talks are often much clearer, which is interesting. So The Great Silence ended in 2006 with the three-volume Sacred Order, Social Order series. 2006, his fully developed theory of culture came out in My Life Among the Death Works. 2008, The Crisis of the Officer Class, and then also a collection of his previously published writings, except for one chapter, called The Jew of Culture. And that was the Sacred Order, Social Order series that was published by the University of Virginia. Alan Woolfolk, Kenneth Piver were responsible for bringing these excellent works out under the supervision of James Davison Hunter at the University of Virginia at Press there. And then in 2007, Charisma, The Gift of Grace and How It Has Been Taken from Us, his long work on charisma also came out. I do apologize, I'm forgetting the name of the editor. And the editors are very important in these projects because some of Reif's notes were rather in a state of disrepair. A good deal of work had to be done. And so we are in a great debt to all of the people that were involved in putting these volumes together because there was a lot of putting together to be done. So his fully developed theory of culture is available in these volumes, which came out 2006. He was still alive for My Life Among the Death Works, and then the rest were posthumous. So that gives you an idea of he became obscure and partly by his own efforts, but he shouldn't be. And that sort of obviously we can get into the content of his work as well, but that gives you sort of his CV, which I think is significant to put out there. Michael, do you want to add anything to that?
I guess the only thing I might add is, you had opened by talking about his broad interdisciplinary approach. And one thing that always struck me is he wrote on Coleridge and Freud in the Department of Political Science at Chicago. And then I recall after we had published the book where we make the claim that Reif is properly understood to be engaged in a philosophic project. I came across the Vienna seminar from just a few years ago. And in the course of that, his son David makes the comment that his father was, in all respects, really a philosopher who was in sociology because it was really the only game in town at that point. And I think that's something that really is worth emphasizing. I don't think sociologists, as the discipline has developed, have all that much interest in or even awareness of this great figure lurking in their disciplinary past, their recent disciplinary past. And I think one of the reasons for that is that he really isn't a sociologist. He's a philosopher. He's engaged in a recognizably philosophic project in that he is concerned with what we might call the great themes of philosophy, God, man, world, right? I mean, everything. He may be looking at it within the confines of an analysis of culture, but that analysis of culture is, let's say, the entrance into the grand problems rather than the only site of inquiry. Maybe that's the way to put it.
I think that's a very good way to put it. Jonathan Imber, who's done so much to keep Reef's work alive, both by putting together the Anthem Companion to Philip Reef in 2018 and by being the general editor of a collection of Reef's articles and book reviews called The Feeling Intellect. So Imber has just been a giant in keeping Reef alive and being an expositor of Reef, by the way, and an expert in Reef in his own right. He's at Wellesley. Amber tells a delightful story of when they would be at sociology conferences, and the reaction to people of his papers would be, "Well, that's very interesting, Philip, but is it sociology?" And apparently, Reeve was delighted by that response. That was kind of what he wanted. So, yeah, good. That I think that is important.
Let me break in with a practical question. I was going to ask about people who are hearing about Reef for the first time, who are impressed with his credentials and some of our reaction to the depth of his work, which we haven't really characterized fully yet. Might ask, what should I read? What short thing can I read to bring me into, a greater understanding of Reef? If somebody were to ask me, I would say, among secondary sources, chapter one of The Philosophy of Philip Reef, which you two co-wrote together, making some important observations about Reef's work, his biography, his value as a philosopher, and his project as a philosophical one. I'd invite you both to react to that. Is that a good recommendation, or is there a better one? But my second question, more importantly, is there any short work of Reef's that people, that a non-specialist, somebody not accustomed to reading the sort of obscurantist style of Reef's later work, might benefit from becoming acquainted with?
Well, I suppose, first of all, thank you. I don't like tooting my own horn. It seems vulgar, but I actually do think that our introduction to the volume is probably the most accessible introduction that I'm aware of to Reef's thought. In particular, that I would say properly situates him, or at least attempts to situate him, within the philosophic tradition. And I can say that for me, idiosyncratically, perhaps my approach to Reef began when Bill sent me a copy of Death Works as a Christmas gift, wholly and completely appropriate, which I then took to Florida and read on the beach, wholly and completely appropriate. And I've told this story before. When I was reading Reef for the first time, I'm a reasonably well-educated guy. I've read a lot in my life. When I was reading Reef, it was the first time, probably since I'd been a student, where I was reading a thinker concerned with the kinds of questions and problems that I was interested in, who I didn't feel like I could, take this guy and kind of slot him in somewhere easily into the history of philosophy. It was the first time in quite a while that I was reading somebody where I kind of felt, oh, I'm reading something really new and interesting here. So for me, the place to start was Death Works. And of all of Reef's works, I think Death Works is the one that I find myself continually returning to. Is there a smaller piece from Reef himself that I might recommend to the uninitiated? I don't know off the top of my head. I mean, Death Works, I think it was Rick Brookhiser who said it was like chewing marbles to read this book. That's a charm to a certain kind of person. I mean, my recommendation for someone who's got a little bit of a background in philosophy and is willing to do the work of working very slowly and carefully through a text, my recommendation would honestly probably be Death Works.
First of all, I don't think anyone's written a bad introduction to his collected works. So the introductions written by the introduction to Death Works is good. The introduction to Crisis of the Officer Class is good. The introduction, the, the I, It's been a very long time since I read it, but I remember some of Imber's contribution to feeling intellect being helpful. Those are all good. And Elizabeth Lash Quinn's introduction to the second edition of The Triumph of the Therapeutic is terrific. So if you want outside of the Anthem Companion to Philip Reeve, Zondervan's book, Sociology and the Sacred, and the Philosophy of Philip Reeve, that is kind of the, by and large, that's the secondary literature. There's one that Michael and I both found very difficult, called, is it The Fire Backstage?
Yeah, by Kane.
We were just it dealt with material that we had no background in, and we found it's highly specialized. Yeah, I would say that those all have helpful material. I'm pleased to hear that the introduction to philosophy, Philip Reeve, the one advantage that you have when you have a lot of people that work at teaching colleges, which many of the people involved in the philosophy, Philip Reeve do, is that they're better expositors. And so one of the things that we do that academics who are largely research oriented or their entire career revolves around only research, as they talk to each other, we of course have to talk to the malinformed public for most of the day. And so it does help to us to be clear is that we have to make hard things clear all the time. And so that introduction really was an effort to make hard things clear. And so you could begin with that. Deathworks is a good place to begin, even though it is brutal. You warm up to it. At least I certainly did. I think I've read it 5 times now or 4 times. And then The Triumph of the Therapeutic is before his style changed. Now, he was never what you would call easy reader, even before he changed his style to the sort of foreboding, inaccessible style that he adopted in 1973. He wasn't exactly an easy guy to read, but Triumph is the success of that and how widely read it was is a testament to the fact that it is certainly it's approachable. And its themes, a lot of people are put off by, I should say this because I've had this pushback a couple of times, and it's understandable, but it's not sustainable. This idea that his grounding partially in Freud is not relevant because if I'm having depression or anxiety, I'm very unlikely to go to a Freudian therapist. Therefore, it's not important to interface with Freud. And of course, the answer to that is Freud is long since. If he was ever contained in the clinic, he has long since escaped the clinic. Freud is one of the absolute pillars of the modern view of the self and the modern view of the self as the self interacts with the group and with culture. The fact that you wouldn't go to a Freudian therapist is entirely irrelevant to the significance of Freud in the culture, which is profound and will last as long as modernity does. Freud's a philosopher who had a clinical practice. Freud is not a clinician with a few philosophic implications. And so the fact that Reif is grounded in Freud simply means that Reif is at the sort of what Michael and you and I would regard as the dark heart of modernity, because, along with Nietzsche and Marx and I don't know, Michael, who else, who does Reif regard as the Weber, the sort of great, what he would call the officer class
Yeah.
of modernity, Freud is arguably the most important. People have Freudian assumptions that have never read Freud and think that he's had no impact on their life at all. So I do think it's a, that the fact that he both Mind of the Moralist and The Triumph of Therapeutic are grounded in Freud, there's no reason to think, well, since I wouldn't go to a Freudian therapist, I don't need to read this. I don't know, do you guys have any comment on that?
I guess maybe something I might want to add to this, and we'll probably talk about this a little bit more later, is that one of the things that is so fascinating about Reif is that while he is a critic of modernity writ large, he's not a critic of modernity in the sense of being one of those people who says, well, we can just go back to Thomism or we can just go back to Aristotelianism. He is instead someone who accepts many of the, let's call them fundamental underlying assumptions of modernity about the nature of the human being while rejecting what modernity is and what it has become, and we might say what it has done to us. I believe the way you've put it in the past is that he is a modern who views modernity as a thoroughgoing disaster. So he's not someone who thinks you can have a return to the past, right? As Nietzsche puts it, no one is free to be a crab. And I think Reif definitely falls under that heading. He's someone who he may not say that we need to accelerate further into decadence to force the break the way Nietzsche does, because there's perhaps something inevitable about this. But he certainly understands that a simple return or retrieval of the conditions of the past is not possible. So
And
whatever's coming is going to be new.
it makes him very pessimistic. Michael, in his essay in The Philosophy of Philip Reeve, pointed out that he's actually more pessimistic than Nietzsche about modernism. And it is true. I mean, if you really want to get to the heart of Reeve, the way that we suggest to do it, and of course there are other ways as well, the ways that we suggest to do it in Philosophy of Philip Reeve is to say this is a modern who views modernity as a catastrophe. And this is a Freudian who's broken in just fundamental ways with Freud while never breaking fully with him.
Michael, I've been wanting to ask you, because I know you're a Nietzsche scholar, is it fair or semi-fair to call Reif our Nietzsche? I mean, is he doing in a sociological 20th century idiom the death of God and the last man and the characteristic sort of elements of Nietzsche's critique, just pushing it further? What do you think of that characterization?
I think there's a lot to recommend it, actually. One of the ways that I think of Reif, especially the Reif of Deathworks, is that Reif is reckoning with the death of God. So the question Nietzsche is asking in part is, what is it going to mean for humanity after the death of God, right? The collapse of let's say all ontotheologies and metaphysics, the loss of the authority of revelation. What's that going to look like for human beings? And Nietzsche's answer is, well, you're either going to get the last man or the overman. And it's going to be a situation that is, good for a small subset of people, the philosophers. But for the rest of humanity, Nietzsche's pretty clear that the death of God is going to be a disaster. And I think Reif is, I would say, maybe bringing some of the tools of sociological theory to bear on the same question. I mean, what there's a sense in, I think, in which what Reif is doing is he's asking, what does society look like when it has when it has abandoned any reference to anything outside of itself? And this is what third culture is. So first culture is in Deathworks is, let's call it, pre-biblical cultures that, let's say, wall off the danger of what he calls the primacy of possibility with taboo and custom and things like this. Second culture is the culture of re the revealed religions, and what he seems to have in mind chiefly is Christianity and Judaism. And then both first culture and second culture are, in some ways, a reflection of an understanding of the sacred or the divine. What characterizes third culture, which I would say is culture after the death of God, is precisely the fact that it is not characterized by a reference to anything outside of itself. It is, I wouldn't say inward looking necessarily, but it is not taking its bearings by anything outside of itself. Would you want to add anything to this, Bill? I don't want to dive too deep
I
into
think
this.
that's right, and it's the thing that's really evolved in my understanding, even since we wrote the book. It's not that I would change anything in the introduction, but it's this incredibly powerful dialectical relationship between culture and the self. Over and over again, when I've explained this, I've tried to talk about Reeve's theory of culture, but really it's almost more a theory of culture as it interacts with the self. And that's Reeve believed that in the second culture, particularly, and he was most concerned with the second culture. Reeve believed that there was something, this is one of his major breaks with Freud. Freud believed what was primary in the personality is the drives. And Reeve said, that makes no sense. It bothered Reeve aesthetically. Partly, he just said, look, a theory is a vision of the highest, and Freud thinks everything comes from below. And he clearly just, that was distasteful to him. So it was partly that, but it was partly how on earth do you get an ordered personality out of the disordered chaos of the drives? And Reeve said, you can't. What's primary in the personality, the primary process is not the id, right? And which is, of course, the first unconscious, the libido, the drives. Freud was mostly interested in libido, the sex drive, but late in life, he began to explore the idea that there's probably also a death drive, that these drives, Reeve doesn't say they don't exist. He just says you can't order the personality on this, because you can't get order out of chaos in that way. So what he said in Zondervan is just so important. Zondervan's book is so important to this because he actually corresponded with Reeve and made him nail this down, because Reeve kind of wanted to be vague about this and Zondervan kind of didn't let him. And so we're all in his debt for what he did, because he corresponded with him and what he arrived at. And you could get this without Reeve making it explicit, but it's really helpful that Zondervan had him make it explicit. Reeve seems to believe that the primary process is basically, it is a primary ordering process. It's and sometimes he called it the primary cultural process. And what he says is that the personality comes about because of a dialectic between the individual and the group, which begins so early that it's not rationally observable. And what the group has that it uses to get hold of the individual personality is the interdicts. And the interdicts in the second culture are the sacred thou shalt nots. And what Reeve says, he says, when the God of Israel first introduced himself, this is a paraphrase, to the Hebrews, he had to tell them what they weren't allowed to do to each other. That was the first lesson. And so if you look at how much of the Ten Commandments and how much of the Jewish law is interdictory, thou shalt not, thou shalt not, thou shalt do no, right? And what Reeve believed was these interdicts are driven into the personality and shape it very early on. And so you can see both the Freudianism, the idea that Reeve says you can never abolish the repression. You can never abolish the unconscious. He believed these things were very real and they were profound insights by Freud, but he believed it operated differently than Freud did. And in one of those ways, as he says, look, these interdicts, these are what actually help to form the personality. They're driven into the personality at an unconscious level when people are very young, and then continue to be reinforced both consciously and unconsciously throughout life. And so the function of culture is not so rich people can go to the opera or go to the orchestra or whatever, or so that degenerates like Michael and I can go to Motorhead. That's not what culture does. Culture fundamentally is what gives the individual his, one place Reeve called it his graven self or his graven, another place he calls it inwardness. And if you have an officer class, the priests, the rabbis, artists who are operating within a functioning culture, that constantly consciously reinforce what's been unconsciously planted. And the fact that you don't get whatever you want doesn't make you sick, right? Freud believed that the more you obeyed your persecuting superego, the stronger the sense of guilt got. And because the repressed always returned, the sicker you got. Reif said, yeah, that's because the interdicts were failing in Freud's culture. He never once worked with someone who is sincerely religious, where the interdicts were still intact. He was dealing with what Reif called post-Jews, people that the internet interdicts, they were around, they were aware, they were still haunted them maybe, but they didn't shape their personality anymore. And neuroses is the result. Whereas Reif says, in a functioning culture, the thou shalt not create your graven character, your inwardness. And Reif was very afraid. This is the source of his pessimism. What happens when you have an officer class which refuses to ratify the interdicts? As a matter of fact, it expends most of their creative efforts destroying them. And what happens when you have people that don't get to have the inwardness and the graven character? And this is not a minor concern with Reif's. Reif is concerned that this is civilization ending. And so his pessimism comes out of his fear that you cannot, you could always have, and again, we don't demean any of these things. Classical Christian schooling and going to mass and all of these things you should do. But Reif was afraid that the culture was so sick and so distanced from the unconscious work of sinking the interdicts into the individual character that this is what you can't go back to. When you break this system, what then? And at first, he thought breaking the system was not possible. And that was the theme of Oscar Wilde and the impossible culture. But by Deathworks, and one of the reasons Deathworks is so dark and so pessimistic, and why one of the chapters of Crisis of the Officer Class is borderline apocalyptic, is because he's trying to grapple with, well, what happens if you don't do this? If, in fact, you have people who aren't developed with a graven character and the ability to cultivate inwardness, because the culture that would have done it died. And that's where he is both Nietzschean and in a sense, and not. Nietzschean thought, well, we'll just transvalue all morals and we'll develop something new, and Reif ain't so sure that's something you can do, which is maybe the ground of Reif being more pessimistic than Nietzsche is. Michael, is that fair?
Yeah, Nietzsche has a hope for a new philosophic legislation that's going to establish new tables of values under which human beings are going to be able to flourish once again. And Reif doesn't hold out any hope that reason is able to do this. There's no possibility of a philosophic legislation of that type in Reif that I can see. Reif is interested, I think, in trying to, let's say, shape souls through his writing, but I think he's aware that he's doing it for a, let's say, a vanishingly small number of people. Nietzsche, on the other hand, I think it's fair to say, has global ambitions for the philosopher, whereas Reif, you know, he, despite being engaged in a philosophical project, I think he would be quite skeptical of the philosopher as commander and legislator in this Nietzschean sense. And I think that the way you're putting it is, I think, exactly right. There is this permanent danger, and Nietzsche sees a permanent danger too. But I think Reif is more pessimistic about our ability to overcome it. And that may just be a product of the fact that, you know, Reif is, you know, writing this stuff about 100 years later. Things have just gotten that much worse.
Yeah, I think that's right.
Yeah, I might add, I gave a talk. I presented my chapter to a colloquium in my department 3 or 4 months ago. One of the images that I used was thinking about the self and culture. Think of a wax cylinder that's inscribed by a stylus or by a needle as it rotates, right? Well, you take away the stylus, or you remove the pressure from the stylus. There's no inscription now upon the cylinder, and you can't use the cylinder to print anything. It's just smooth, or it's nearly smooth. The process of cultural decline is not just a process of the deterioration of certain institutions. It's that they're no longer able to transmit or inscribe that great Reifian word, inscribe selfhood on the individuals that make it up. They're not human they're less and less recognizable as selves in any sense any longer. And that raises both the sort of pessimistic, the apocalyptic question: what happens? What's next? Where does the fourth culture come from? Do we even have the language in which to conceive of a possible fourth culture? But the more practical question I would like to pose to you guys: how does one be a self? How does one be a father and a grandfather to people who will live in the remnants of the anti-culture long after we're gone? What kind of selfhood can they hope for? Can one be a fugitive second world self in what's coming?
It's interesting because he had a he Reef's religious views are complicated. And by complicated, I mean I spent 55 pages in the volume attempting to figure out what they were. They get a little more clear, and some of this other stuff is a little more clear in his talks. But Reef's religious views are complicated. He started out very hostile to Christianity, if you read his early work. And by Deathworks, he refers to Jews and Christians as we. Which is obviously a good, considerable revision of his earlier view of Christianity. But one of the things that you might say, very common in our spaces, is to think about Rod Dreher's Benedict option. But Reef was really brusquely contemptuous of anything that smacked of fundamentalism, always, even in his late work. His view of what are now, and forgive me if we have Jewish listeners and I don't necessarily understand the divisions among Judaism, but what you might think of as the ultra-Orthodox. And I think that might have been the phrase that Reif used. He thought that that was a hopeless overreaction to modernity, not the continuing of tradition that they thought it was. And that's me explaining what he just said in one line. Fundamentalist Christianity, his contempt dripped off the page. He referred to Pentecostalism as an insane evangel. Now, he may not have meant all Pentecostalism. I think he was largely referring to megachurch, mega preachers, not everyone who's a Pentecostal, but the whole, or you might even say the megachurch phenomenon, that the guy that he names is Pentecostal, as an insane evangel. And obviously he wasn't around for the Benedict option, but I don't think he thinks there's anywhere to. Now, that doesn't mean that we can't carve out places to attempt to be, but he, I think, seemed very pessimistic anytime he encountered Jewish or Christian, what we might call rigorism. He was in the modern context, not say the medieval context where he admired it. In the modern context, he wasn't very patient with it. So if you think about, and he regarded in his talks, he seems to implicate that he thinks that fundamental Islam is just another overreaction to modernity, like a wounded reaction to modernity, much in the same way that he characterized those reactions in Judaism and in Christianity. So what might you say if it, to retreat into severity or separatism, he didn't seem to think that would help. Michael, what would you add to that?
So he definitely sees that the wheels are coming off. And I think that in the time since he's died, you can see this more and more. Something has gone very, very wrong in the West. And I think, what you're describing, I'm tempted to say his critique would be that, this is putting on a costume in a way. Turning your back on the world like that is not necessarily going to be helpful to you. Adopting certain outward traits is not necessarily going to be helpful to you. And I think that's partly because, as much as many people might want to be purely second world people, Reef says on a couple of different occasions that, all of us today have one foot in the second and one foot in the third. We are all to one degree or another kind of torn between the two. And I think that at the end of the day, this ends up being something that the individual has to find a way to navigate for himself or herself. And this is maybe a recurring theme in the way I think about a lot of these issues. I think things are where they are today, and you have to kind of tend to your own garden. things are significantly deranged, all around us, right? I mean, I'm not making a political point. I'm making a, let's say, a cultural point or a social point. And I tend to think the best you can do is work very, very hard to keep those you love from being harmed by it. And that may be me falling prey to a certain kind of Reefian pessimism.
Well, and there's a couple things. First of all, again, Reef's view of ultra-Orthodoxy or of Pentecostalism isn't necessarily mine or Michael's. I'm just passing, I have dear friends who are Pentecostal house pastors. I'm just saying that was his view, at least of the TV version. And again, so we don't wish to have our Pentecostal friends think that we're disrespecting them here if we're not, or our ultra-Orthodox friends if we have any. But that was kind of his view, at least at his most pessimistic. It is interesting, though. I said that he didn't think rigorism would work. That's an overstatement. Let me try to revise that a little bit. He believed a symptom of the third culture person is what he called order hopping. So that you're sort of a Zen Buddhist on Monday and an atheist on Tuesday, and experimenting in sex magic on Thursday, but none of it's really all that real. And I know Chris, actually, our host, wrote a really good chapter on Reef and self-examination, and about that kind of order hopping, that if you don't have the self, the world turns into a theater, where you're just an actor taking on various roles. But with no self to return to when the curtains close. The curtains are always open and you're always acting. You're always just trying new things on. And he thought modern people were damned to that if they didn't have a sort of a graven character. I said rigorism is no answer. In some ways, rigorism is. So there's a chapter, is it the second chapter of Crisis of the Officer Class, Michael? Where he talks about what will be necessary to have, it's called Toward a Fourth Culture.
I thought it was later in the book, but I've got the book right here, so I will actually just check to see if it's
Okay.
in chapter.
Where he gives his prescription, first of all, he says that the third culture, the one we're in now, it's just one sentence, but it is very clear that he thinks it will end in apocalyptic violence, because people with no graven selves will
It's
all
chapter
be killed.
six.
It's chapter six, that people with no graven selves. Will ultimately, he called violence the therapy of therapies. That is to say, the ultimate lowering of standards to resolve feeling of tension is indulging in bloodlust, right? So he thought that the third culture would end in apocalyptic violence. There's a beautiful passage where he describes the glass of modern skyscrapers and how they all reflect each other. So they all reference each other, and we can see our distorted image in them. But what we really want to do is smash the glass. And that's kind of his view of the construction of modernity. It's one of my favorite passages in Reef. But he also believed that a fourth culture, there would be severe interdicts returning. He said, particularly following Aristotle in the sense of touch. He said that the sense of touch would be severely restricted, that the idea of the celibate schoolmaster, so important in both Catholicism and in Judaism in some ways, but particularly, I think he was referring to the Christian, the idea that Oxford dons had to be celibate, priests had to be celibate, even the virginal school marm of out west with no family of her own. He said that's going to have to return because the officer class, the instructing class, must themselves live rigorously in sacred order, or they don't have any ability to implant it in anybody else. So it's interesting, there's a tension there between his dislike of what we might call fundamentalist versions of religion and his demand for a sort of rigorism that he understands. And he only outlines it in the most grayest of shades. But whatever it is, it won't look quite like fundamentalism.
It won't be performative. It will be truly interior, is maybe the way I would put it.
Yeah, that's good. Yeah, I think that. Thank you, Michael. That's probably it.
That's a great answer. Thanks to both of you. We're coming up close to the end of an hour. now, and I wondered if we might conclude with some closing thoughts. Either I was going to ask, are there any additional elements we haven't mentioned of Reef's thought that are really kind of key to understanding him? And is there a prospect of a kind of revived Reefian project, Reefian philosophy, not merely reading and interpreting Reef and promulgating more of his works, but is there the possibility of anyone, perhaps people smarter with more leisure than us, working in a Reefian idiom in the middle and latter part of the 21st century?
I think that what we've seen since the publication of Death Works in 2006 is a slow but ever increasing spread of Reef's influence. Off the top of my head, I am aware of at least three scholars in Eastern Europe and Russia who have worked on Reef a little bit. We mention a couple of them in our introduction. So I do think Reef's influence is growing. I think there's a recognition that what he's doing, especially in his later work, is capable of speaking very specifically, not just to, let's say, the cultural moment we are in, but the human predicament of the 20th and 21st century, more generally. Nietzsche makes a comment that some people are born posthumously, and it may be that Reef is going to be one of those thinkers who is born posthumously. He may, 100 years from now, enter the tradition. I'm thinking of that quip from Nietzsche that it's going to take 100 years for him to be understood. Maybe it'll take 200 years for Reef to be understood. But I do think that you're going to see more and more people adopting Reef as part of their intellectual toolbox in the same way that you have today. You have Straussians, and then you have, people who have read Strauss because Strauss has, in a way, become part of the canon, and he provides a set of hermeneutic tools in one's intellectual toolbox. I think you're going to see something similar with Reef. And Reef certainly does provide a rich set of hermeneutic and diagnostic tools to have in one's intellectual toolbox, even if one is not a so-called Reefian.
I love that answer, and he is such a wide-ranging thinker that there are many aspects to his work that we haven't talked about at all. One of my favorite that I'm most interested in is his notion of the primacy of possibility and the return of third culture people in a sense of play to that vast and limitless and as consequently dangerous space. I've found that to be an incredible tool. To explain not only pagan Greek texts, but also the fiction and the creative productions of a lot of modern people. It was a very profound insight, and that's just one of many. Again, there is a lot there to work with. His attack on Weber's notion of charisma. Which, of course, if you know Weber, that's one of Weber's central teachings. This is not a small thing to go after Weber on charisma. It's a central thing. And when you get through to the end of it, you realize he's right. Weber's concept of charisma is a mess. And Reef dismantles it and offers something better. I mean, so there is a lot to him. He is very wide-ranging. And so I think Michael's right that we have interpretive tools here, even if somebody's not all in as a Reefian. And I think that's correct. I do think there are people that are beginning to incorporate Reef into wider critiques of modernity. Elizabeth Lash Quinn and Ars Wittae certainly did that. And Elizabeth Lash Quinn advocates in the last chapter of Our Philosophy of Philip Reef, she advocates, she has a chapter called Towards a Reefian Sensibility. And she is very definitely incorporated Reef, but with many other thinkers in her concern that people who are totally focused on the self paradoxically make the self vanish. And that's central to a lot of her criticism of modernity. She's really integrated reef into that and used reef, but without it being simply reefian. So I think we're already seeing that with her work. I'm sure we'll see it. But Carl Truman has made tremendous use of reef in attempting to explain to Protestants why modern culture is not only hostile to them, but why their attempts to answer modern culture just fall flat, that it's become so radically alien to them. And reefing categories have been useful to Truman in his work. The Rise and Triumph of the Modern Self is a place where you can see reef's influence without it being a reefian text. There's a lot of other thinkers in there as well. So I do think that's already starting. Our attempt to bring into publication these unpublished seminars and lectures is very much our attempt to accelerate this, because we have found, maybe with the exception of one series, that the spoken reef is much more approachable than the written reef. And he gets into some stuff that he only alludes to. In other places, a couple of things that are of the greatest importance to me in my investigations and reef come out much more clearly. And so we hope that as this project, again, it's a huge project, it's going to take a while. This is not coming out next week. But as we work through this project, I think that that's going to help also make reef much more accessible. I do think that if we do it right, God willing, people may go to the lectures first. Because they're actually more accessible than the books. It's not to say that you shouldn't go to the books. We've all gotten so much out of them. We haven't even talked about Crisis of the Officer Class, which I actually have started to prefer to Death Works. I do think this is a giant opportunity to work with these lectures and seminars as a way to pr promote him.
Do you have a prospective timeline on the realization of that project? I realize it's all somewhat still
Well,
up
when
in
we
the
sent
air.
the grant in, we told them, I think we told them 3 years. It might not take that long. Who knows? Once we all start get going and get rolling. But when we wrote up a huge grant for this, and as we wrote it up, Professor Lash Quinn said to me, "I had not realized how huge this project was until we tried to explain it to someone else." And it is what we had an absolute insane deadline on where we thought everybody would be done. But as we worked on the grant, we realized that, oh my goodness, this is a much larger project than we had initially thought of. So I think it would be 2 to 3 years.
Okay, that's great. We'll look for it in the late 2020s then.
God willing. And we certainly have a wonderful a team together and an enthusiastic team and an intense team, and that's been it's been a privilege to work with them. So yeah, that's something we look forward to.
Okay. Any final words about Reef when we wrap up?
Maybe I'll just say one little thing about the lectures that are going to come out sometime. One of the things that I have really appreciated about the lectures and the seminar transcripts that we've been looking at is, as Bill said, they're very accessible. But one of the things you get a sense of is Reef in so many ways is a very intimidating man. I mean, you even look at the photos of the guy and you're like, he would not want me to be involved in a project devoted to him. But nonetheless, in the lectures, there is a kind of sparkling wit and warmth that really comes through. And even at his darkest, you get in the books, you get hints of this. I mean, there are passages in Death Works where I think you start to see that sparkling wit come through. But Philip Reeve, the teacher, is very different in some ways from Philip Reeve, the author. And I think a lot of people are going to respond quite favorably to Philip Reeve, the teacher, and the kind of character he exhibits as a teacher. He's really very charming, in a way that reading, say, Death Works might not lead you to necessarily expect.
I agree.
It's fantastic. Thank you so much to both of our guests today on The Sower, Michael Harding of Montgomery College and Bill Batchelder of Waynesburg University. I'm Chris Annadale, and you've been listening to The Sower, a podcast of the Ciceronian Society. To learn more about us, about this podcast and our other programming, please visit ciceroniansociety.org. Gentlemen, thank you both.
Thank you, Chris.
Yeah, thank you for having us.